Okay.
The evening questions and entertainment. Dear Ajahn, why are some of us, especially me, compulsive doers? We seem to need to do at least one thing, maybe a physical or mental activity, at all times. Thank you. Okay, the reason is, it's because I first read this on the walls of the philosophy department at Cambridge University. In those days, graffiti actually meant something, and it was very witty and the sorts of things you'd remember. And it was, to do is to be, and that was Descartes. And then it was Jean-Paul Sartre. He sort of turned that famous saying, to do is to be, and said, to be is to do. And so they had like, to do is to be, and that was Descartes. And then to be is to do, Jean-Paul Sartre. And underneath, summing it all up, the great American philosopher, do-be-do-be-do, Frank Sinatra. And that's really good, really good. Witticism from the university. But those first two philosophers, they actually noticed being and doing are very closely connected. And if you don't do anything, you don't exist. And that is the reason why we are compulsive doers. Because we want to exist. We want to show we're here. Which is why it's just so difficult to disappear. Because that's what happens when you do nothing. You just vanish. And that's the scariest thing for a human being to do. That's why, by doing nothing, by letting things be, you get the insight into anatta, non-self. It's all connected together. If you strive to meditate, number one, you never get peaceful. And you never understand this connection between doing and being. That's why many of you define yourself by what you do. I am a monk. That's what I do. I am a doctor. That's what I do. I am, what else are you? I am a caretaker, because that's what I do. So many of you define yourself by what you do, which is one of the reasons when you retire and you've got nothing to do, why many people just die. They stop existing. There's no purpose to the life anymore. Which is why I love you, Barbara, you're just so funny. Which is why even when we've got nothing to do, we do something just to show we're still here. So it's scary to do nothing. That's why even here, you know, you don't have many things to do. But a lot of times you volunteer to do extra work. Why is that? Why is that? Because you want to exist. You want to do something. Sitting here, you're just vanishing, not doing anything. And that really challenges your identity. That's one of the reasons why it's hard to stop. But what happens is you do so much, after a while you get fed up and tired with all this doing. So there's a certain amount of negativity and suffering into doing, which I exploit and you exploit as well. It's just so nice to have a rest for a few seconds or a few days on this retreat. And what happens? You get happy. Something strange happens when you stop doing something. You get peace of mind. You're peaceful. It's still. It's a bit scary because you're vanishing, but still it feels good. And it's that happiness, that feel good, that joy, that is what overcomes the fear. I remember once just on the edge of a deep meditation, and this is how it felt like. You're on the edge, you know to go in there is going to be really profound, but hellishly scary. You know, I've really got to disappear to take that last step into deep meditation. Oh, that's just too scary. I don't want to do that. That's just too much fear. But it's just so nice. But I can't do it, I'm afraid. But it's just so beautiful in there. I know it's going to be nice, but I can't do it. What the hell? And you go for it. And that's what happens. The joy, the bliss, the ecstasy, it just pulls you in spite of your fear. So it's the bliss, the happiness, is usually for many people what overcomes the fear of disappearing. Yeah, it's scary stuff which you're doing here, but so much fun. What the hell? I'm going for it. You talk about extreme sports. Meditation is the most extreme of sports. You risk your body an injury doing extreme sports. Doing meditation, you risk your mind. It's going to go. It's going to disappear. Rah! So that's actually why it's hard to stop doing things. Because it means you have to disappear. Your sense of self, your ego, who you think you are, has to vanish. Just for a short while. And how you do that is just too much fun. You have to. Why not? Give it a try. See what happens. And then you understand things like Four Noble Truths and non-self. You've got nothing to lose anyway. There's nobody in here. Being a doctor, being a secretary, being a monk, it's all just what's added on. It's not real. Yes, my good man.
Can I ask a question?
Nope. Go on. Being and doing, are they the same one? Actually, they're so connected. The first of the asavas is like karma asava, which is that particular type of doing which wants to gather sensory pleasure. So it's basically the going out just to have a good time. That's the asavas are the outflowings of the mind. Instead of staying inside, where it's nice and peaceful and safe and lovely, we send our mind out. And the karmas was into the world of the five senses, looking for pleasure in there. And then there's the avijja-asava, which is just because of stupidity, ignorance. And then there's bhava-asava. Now that is the one of being, of existing. That is the one which we go out and do something to prove that we are. Yeah, that's what happens. You disappear. You vanish your sense of self when you don't do things. Then you sort of, you know, your personality, who you take yourself to be, is built up by all those actions you've done in the past. I'm a murderer, I'm a bad guy, I'm a thief, you know, I'm an academic, I'm a doctor, I'm a professor. You know, whatever it is, that's all what you've done so far in your life, or what you're doing now. And that's who you take yourself to be.
What's left over at the end of that is the syncretism. So very strong, and when it's strong, it's profound sense of the present moment. That got me.
Exactly, that's all there was anyway. All this other stuff intrudes on the reality. It's just fake stuff. So it's a bit scary, this, what you're doing here. But it's fun. Look, you know, sometimes that. Whatever these you do in these scary things, you want to say, where does this lead to? I mean, what happens if you follow this path for long enough? And that's why you know, it's nice to have someone like me here. So this is what will happen to you if you carry on this path. So you can see I'm just a happy old guy. And so, you know, it's not a bad thing to sort of aim for.
That was really sure. That's what I used. That's what I used.
Good, yeah. Excellent. Yeah, this is what...
You're okay.
Yeah, so it must be okay. I mean, you will end up telling bad jokes and doing what you want. So that's actually what happened. That's why it's so hard to let go of doing. What do you mean, stream of consciousnesses, plural? Is it temporal bits and or six consciousnesses? Yeah, this is, every now and again, you just add a little bit more to what you've said before. And for many years, I used to call it stream of consciousness. But actually, that's an inaccurate even translation. Sometimes you look at the Pali, the way the Buddha taught, and you look at it closer, and you always see new things which you missed. Stream of consciousnesses. It's beautiful. Just like the stream of water. No molecule of water is the same as the other molecules of water. These are totally different things. So even, not just the body of water is different today than was there yesterday, but every molecule of water is different. The stream of consciousnesses is what you take to be your mind. And what that really means is I developed this fruit salad simile many years ago to try and explain what happens. And because there are six senses, six main senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing is the sixth sense. And I just, for this simile, every one of those senses I assigned a different type of fruit. So the eye consciousness I just called apple, you know, apple of the eye. The nose consciousness smell I called like banana. Because some people have got noses like bananas. And the ears, I use cauliflower. It's not really a fruit, but it's close enough. Cauliflower ears, when you get bang. Just something I could remember. And for taste, I use mango, because I like mangoes, they taste beautiful. And what is it? For touch. What do I use for touch? What do I use, remember? I have to forget what I use.
Pineapple?
Okay, pineapple. Okay. What do I use for touch in my simile? I call it pineapple, okay. Pineapple is for touch. And lastly, for the mind, the knowing coconut. So those are the six fruits. Now, apple represents the eye, cauliflower, hearing, banana, smelling, mango, tasting, pineapple is touch, and coconut is knowing. So what it's like, what the stream of consciousness is, like you have a plate, and you've got an apple on the plate. Only for a moment, then the apple vanishes, followed by a coconut. And the coconut vanishes, followed by a cauliflower. And the cauliflower vanishes, followed by a coconut. Then another cauliflower, then another coconut, then another cauliflower, then another coconut. And then it may be sort of a pineapple, then the coconut, another pineapple, coconut. So the fruits change. Yeah, they're all fruits or veggies or something, but they keep on changing. They're not the same thing. And the reason why the coconut follows after every fruit is because what you hear, that's the cauliflower, then you know you've heard it. The mind follows directly afterwards. You see, and then you know you see. You know, and then you know that you knew. That is the myth of self-identity. It's not that you know, it's you know that you knew. The coconut, and then another coconut. And that gives you the illusion that this knower is continuous. That you're always knowing something. You always have a coconut on your plate. But when you see, you don't know you see. As soon a moment after you've seen something, then you know that you saw. That is the way our consciousness works. One sense door at a time. Usually followed by knowing. And because every sense door is followed by knowing, you see, then you know you saw. You hear, then you know you heard. It gives a sameness to this conscious process. There's something similar to seeing and to touching and to hearing and to smelling and to tasting. There's something similar there. What do those have in common? But they are totally different sensory experiences. You know, even processed through a different part of the brain. What makes them appear the same? What makes them appear the same is that each one of those is followed by knowing. And that gives it the sameness, which gives the illusion of a continuous flow of consciousness, singular. And it's not, it's consciousnesses. And the way you get the insight into this one is you've got to recognize what the coconut is. What mind consciousness is when it's not associated with any of the other five consciousnesses. So you're no longer seeing, you're no longer hearing, you're no longer smelling, tasting or touching. Those five senses have disappeared for a long period of time. That's what we do in this meditation. Calm the body down so the sensory experience of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching has gone. And the one which is left is the mind. You're knowing. And there's no other senses going on, just mind. That's what happens in a deep meditation. When you can't hear, you can't feel the body, it's just mind consciousness, nothing else. And then you know what that mind consciousness is. You start to recognize it. And then you start to appreciate the accuracy of that simile. Once you know what the coconut is, when it's not sort of associated with other things, just pure coconut and nothing else, then you can see what happens in this so-called stream of consciousness. It's not a stream of consciousness, it's a stream of consciousnesses. Six different fruits or vegetables appearing and then totally disappearing, and then another fruit coming up. And that's what our consciousness is. We see that it's separate, particular moments of consciousness, which means no longer do we associate this with me. Otherwise, which one is the real me? Am I the coconut? Am I the apple? Am I a cauliflower? Am I a mushy mushroom? What am I? That's a nickname. What am I? You're none of these. That challenges the other half of your sense of self, the one who knows. It's not the one who knows. It's the many, many, many billions and zillions of knowings. Not the one, but the zillions of knowings, all in a sequence. So it's not the one which knows. It's a stream of consciousnesses, plural. Now, if you get your head around that, you're doing well. But in the meantime, let's get a few more jokes. You always practice solitude, yet you always praise solitude, or practice solitude, or praise solitude, yet your life now is far from solitude. Then I thought it must be act of compassion that you want to spread the Dharma, but it confuses me when you sign books for streams of people. Why do you say something to these sorts of things? Is it just to make people happy? That's like helping the proliferation of desire of people rather than the Dhamma. To me, I really try my best to practice what you teach, so please help me to understand why the choices of your life seem to be contrary to some of your teachings. Thanks, cheers. I've got no choice. It's not up to me. You know, sometimes it's true. Sometimes you're crowded with people. And want to sign your books or give photographs. So when I was doing that recently in Indonesia, I mean, it was absolutely crazy. You know, it's hours and hours of having your photograph taken and signing books, and then photograph taken and signing books. And I said, that's not what I became a monk for. And there was a few moments there when I started inclining to aversion. I don't want to do this. Why do I do this? And I stopped myself very quickly. I said, no, if you get negative and you start to control things, then I've lost the plot. So I said, I just sat there and just very peacefully just signed books, smile, sign the books, smile, sign the books, smile. Because for a person in my position, it's not what you do, but how you do it is the most important. So if I try to control my life, I'm not letting go. If I run away and just try and hide in solitude, I'm just controlling my life. So instead, I just make peace. I'm kind and I'm gentle. That's my practice. And you know, a lot of time you try and control your life and you try and make it just so, and it all goes wrong. And I had these great ideas of just being like a hermit monk and doing absolutely nothing. Being in solitude for the rest of my life. And one of the things which changed me, I just fantasized one day. Because somebody told me that just to the, quite a few, maybe 500 kilometers to the east of here, there's this beautiful Nullarbor plain. And under that plain there's many, many caves with water. And I thought, what a great place to be a hermit. I thought I'd go in there with a supply of food and just live in the cave and meditate underground. Plenty of water, wouldn't need much to eat. And just live as a hermit for weeks and weeks and weeks on end. And that was like a dream for me. But then I started to think, what would happen next? And sure enough, sooner or later, someone would find me. And they would tell the newspapers. Now that is newsworthy. Like, you know, a guy living in a cave in the Nullarbor as a hermit. That would be weird. That's the sort of stuff which people like to read. They've read enough about politicians and movie stars and sex scandals. Like a hermit staying for years underground. Now that's really interesting. So you get a newspaper article, and then after that you get someone like 60 Minutes doing a piece on you. And that will make you famous. And after you become famous, you'll have all these Japanese tourists actually coming in their buses. There's a joke about that. Please, I do apologize to Japanese people here, but you've got a reputation. And the story is that there was somebody who hijacked a tourist bus and stole people's money. The good news is that there's 1,000 photographs of the culprit because it was a Japanese tourist bus. Click, 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 click. Always taking photographs of everything. So by letting go of control, you just make yourself peaceful. So it's always making peace, being kind, being gentle. And it's very powerful because you spend, you know, a lot of the day doing stupid things like that, and then you get really tired, you have to give another talk. You just go and meditate somewhere and get into very deep meditation. Now always... I was talking to the monks about that yesterday. That always surprised me. Why is it that you can do lots and lots of things and then you can suddenly turn off and get into deep meditation? And the reason is it's the way you do that work. Now, if you try and control, I want to get rid of this, you know, stupid people, I don't want to get rid of signing books so I can go off and meditate, then you'll never understand what the Dharma is. You'll never get into deep meditation. But if you're doing your job and very happy to do it, making peace, being kind, being gentle, washing the dishes, cleaning the toilets, having your photograph taken, you're making peace, being kind, being gentle all that time. And then when people do go, that momentum of making peace, being kind, being gentle continues on, and you just close your eyes and you stop. You get very peaceful very quickly. So it's not just solitude. Is how you relate to solitude and how you relate to being with people. And again, when I was talking to the monks, there was a lot of monks I knew. When I was growing up as a young monk in Thailand, in the forest monasteries, I had a compassionate streak in me, you know, just always saying yes to people. So I got landed with doing all the visas for the Western monks in Thailand at that time. That was a huge amount of work. You know, having to, you know, get all their details, get their passports, and then just take them to all the senior monks in the district, then take it to Bangkok to get some more signatures, and then take it to the immigration office. Doing that for all these monks, you know, so that they could spend a lot of time meditating quietly. And I thought I was sacrificing that. I was so happy that I was doing this so other monks could live in solitude and wouldn't need to bother with anything like this. And then when we'd meet, now I'd ask them how their meditation was going. And they'd ask me how my meditation was going. And mine was much deeper. What have you guys been up to? You had all this solitude. I've been working my butt off for you guys, going up and down Bangkok. How come that your meditation is not so good and my meditation is deeper? And I realized after a lot of contemplating and insight, it's the way they were using solitude. Now, wanting it for themselves. Now, the selfless, I want to be peaceful. I want to get this. And I was actually letting go. I was sacrificing. And to meditate, you have to sacrifice. You have to let go. You have to stop controlling. And that was why my meditation was deeper. Even though I was doing more work in those early years than many other monks. It's fascinating. This is actually how you meditate. Never think that compassion at work, dana, being generous, precepts, you know, serving the community, Buddhist fellowship or Buddhist society, never think that that is not meditating. If you do it rightly, as selflessness, kindness, making peace, being kind, being generous, if you do it rightly with the correct attitude, you build up this great store of merit. And I don't mean like in the law of karma, like money. It's store of attitude, meritorious attitude, the way you serve, the way you're kind, the way you make peace. You store this up so that when you have the chance to sit, you're way ahead of everybody else. That's actually how it works. So don't just think the amount of time I sit and meditate, or I'm going to try and organize my life, make my pile. Sometimes this is the other thing which I fantasized. I'm going to sort of get some donations, a lot of donations, not for the Buddhist Society, just for me. And I'm going to give it to my financial advisor so they can invest it, so I can live in my cave forever. And instead of actually going to all these dharanas and people giving me what they think I like to eat, which causes me tummy ache, I'll have my personal cook, which I pay from the fund. So I order exactly what I want every day. And none of this sort of going interviews and talking to people. I'm having my photograph taken or books. So I can have the perfect situation so I can meditate for 3 years, 10 years, however long it takes. No sort of interruptions at all. No work at all. Just perfect solitude, perfect food, my own air conditioner in there so I can just take it just right. Instead of in here, if I put it my temperature, I was born in England, I like it cold. And people say, turn the aircon up, it's freezing up here. So I turn it up for you guys and I'm sweating. But in my own little apartment or whatever it is, I get it just right, the food I like, and just no sort of interruptions at all. And of course you saw through that straight away. That you'd be so dry of happiness. No spiritual energy inside of you. It wouldn't work. The way your mind works, it's not just what's in it for you. It's how much you can let go. That is what creates the deep meditations. How much you can abandon. How much you can be kind. Not how much you want. That's how it works. So, as I teach, so I live. I just don't control things. So that's actually what happens. That's my life. Just totally letting go. Because Ajahn Chah would say that, because he went to see, I remember this, I was thinking about this a couple of days ago. He went to see this great monk in Thailand, Ajahn Chah. He was supposed to be one of the great monks in Thailand. And Ajahn Chah, when they were young, they used to wander the forest together. So he went to see his old friend, and Ajahn Chah asked Ajahn Chah, how are things? How's your life? And he said, I'm like a monkey in a cage, and all these ladies keep poking me. And I can appreciate that now, because that's what people do to me. I'm this little monkey in a cage, and you keep poking me and taking my photograph and getting me to my soapbox. That's what it feels like. But I'm happy being the monkey in the cage. I've got no freedom. But I've given up my freedom a long time ago. Do you understand? When you give up your own freedom, then you're really free. that clear? Okay. When you want freedom, you're in prison. The problem I see encourage people not to think. Oh, here we go, not thinking again. I wish people would actually do that. Wouldn't we then have no questions left? We can have a nice, easy evening. But anyway, you've been thinking. The problem I see encourage people not to think is then people translate that into not learning. They don't read sutras and just sit there. Is enough. So is that what you mean? No need to study what? The one who knows and sees how to say. Can I understand as I can read the suttas and just contemplate into thoughts? How do you read the suttas without some sort of thinking? Thank you. Okay, when you meditate, you stop thinking. When you read the suttas, then you think. When you plan to come here, you have to think and you have to plan for the future. It's the right thing at the right time. So, yeah, sure, when you're reading the suttas, think. But when you meditate, stop it. The trouble is, when you meditate, when you don't have to think, can you stop thinking? That's the trouble, isn't it? It's, you know, totally out of control. You know, the thinking is just a habit. It's an addiction. You can't stop it. So, you've read all the, you know, you've read enough suttas. You've already exceeded your limit of thinking for your life. You've already thought too much. So now shut up. Because a lot of time I like thinking. In thinking, I like to compare it to talking back at life. Inside, you're talking back at life. So you're not listening to life. To really listen to life, you have to be silent. If you have a conversation with life, you're mostly talking back at it. Have you ever been with a partner and you're trying to tell them something and they keep talking back at you? There's one. You've just admitted what your relationship with your partner is like. Anyway, no. That's what it's like for most people. You know, that people don't listen to each other. They're always talking. Even if they're not, their mouth is not moving, their brain is. Here she goes again. How many times do I have to listen to this? Doesn't she know I'm busy? Yes, okay, come on. In other words, people are thinking, they're not listening. But if you're quiet inside, really silent, it's amazing how much you can hear. Sometimes people say that meditation monks have psychic powers. They can read your mind. Most of the time, it's just they're quiet. They're silent. And they can read all the other signs which you give so easily. It's not reading minds. It's just being silent and picking up more information, that's all. If you're silent and don't think so much, you can see so much more. So that's why silence is a great source of wisdom. That's why when you're meditating, sort of please be quiet. If you're reading a sutta, fine, you can think. But don't do the wrong thing at the wrong time. The most difficult thing to let go of is our children, especially for a mother. Did your mother, poor mother, yearn for you? How does one let go of our children? By realizing it is not your child. Where did your child come from? It didn't come from out of your womb. Because you know when it comes out, it's already a being with history. Its personality and character is very different than you and very different from your father. That reminds me of another story. There was this old man, he was on his deathbed. And his wife was by the bedside, you know, sort of holding his hand, easing his pain in the last few minutes of his life. And next to his wife was his four children. There were three tall, strapping, blue-eyed, blonde kids. And the other one was short, squat, dark-haired with brown eyes. You know, this is how to tell a joke. You just make people suffer. You just hold it for a while. So people's anticipation of the punchline can build up. And just before he died, the husband looked at his wife and said, "Darling, I'm about to die. There's something I've always been wondering. please tell me the truth. I won't blame you. I'm about to die. It's too late for scolding you. That squat boy, my son. Is he really mine? Because he's different from the other three. And the wife looked at him and smiled and said, I swear on my mother's grave, that's your son. That's ours, no one else's. You don't need to worry, that's your son. And so he died very peacefully. And as soon as he passed away, she said to herself, I'm glad he didn't ask about the other three. So is it your child? Which you're worried about? You don't know, do you, you fathers? So why are you worrying about children? It may not be yours after all. Even you mothers, it comes, it just, you know, the past life comes into your womb and you look after it, but it's not yours. That's how we deal with children. It's not my child. As soon as you say it's my child, that's where all the suffering comes from. This is a being entrusted to you, mothers and fathers, to nurture for, I don't know, 18, 20 years, sometimes longer these days, because you're stupid, you don't kick your kid out of the house. You're 18, you're of age, get out. You should be like birds. You see birds in nature, they sit on the eggs. If you think you've got a sore bum meditating just for an hour, think of those birds on those rough eggs, sitting day after day after day. And that really is a sore on your bottom. But they'll do that until those eggs are hatched. And then they'll go and find worms all day, you know, to feed their young. And they'll go hungry themselves. And once their birds are big enough, they'll teach them to fly. And once they can fly by themselves, that's it, Junior. Off you go. I'm leaving. Those birds are really smart. You should do that to your kids. Yeah, you raise them and they get a sore bum and sore everything else. And you work really hard to make sure they do well at school. But as soon as they're old enough to look after themselves, just like the birds, kick them out of the nest. We're going off to our holidays. You go and look after yourself. Can you do that? No, because it's my son. He needs me. Even though he's 50 years old. You're crazy, you mothers. So it's because it's my son and my daughter. That's the reason we can't let them go. The my delusion gives us a sense of ownership. But you should know it's just the being comes into your life and leaves you. It's not yours. If you can understand that, then it's very easy to stop the attachment to children. Otherwise, they'll drive you crazy for your whole life. How long do you have to look after those kids? Isn't there a time you can be free? So that's a good thing. They're not mine. You may check their DNA and you might prove it. You mentioned last night that stepping back from your thoughts is one way of not identifying and attaching to them, and that this is the beginning of this process. What are some other ways that one can detach from thoughts and so deepen one's insight into their selfless nature? Meditating is a good thing. Following all my instructions and doing the shut up method. Breathing in, shut, breathing out, up. Breathing in, shut, breathing out, up. After a while it works, you stop thinking. Seeing the space between thoughts when one thought has finished and another thought has not begun. In those spaces, there's silence. And that's a very nice way to to learn about what it's like to be silent, and after a while you like it so much you stay silent. I know there was this one guy, I think he wrote a book, that when he was very young, you know, he used to read comics all day. And you know, in the comics they had these little thought bubbles, like these, what do you call it? Yeah, like bubbles, like balloons, thought balloons. And had the speech in it, you know, where the one comic person was speaking to another. And he imagined these little balloons with nothing in it. Just empty balloons with no speech. And that's how he got silent. It's actually quite a skillful means, if you read a lot of comics. So that's another useful way. And we've got the halfway house of doing those mantras. Now you say them, because that means you can't think about anything, you just have to think of Om Mani Padme Hum, but put spaces in there, lengthen the spaces until there's hardly any more Oms or Manis, it's just space, and then you can just stay in the space. Those are really good ways of detaching from thoughts. People already have some bad karma from their previous life or birth. Speak for yourself. How can we remove that? By meditation or some other way? How you remove that is just untying the connection to your past. All that karma, the bad karma, is from the past. Why do you keep bringing up the past? You don't have to. You can drop it all, let it go. It's amazing insight to know that is possible. I say, and hopefully you've got enough faith and confidence in me, it is allowable, it can be done. Why not do it? Because you think you shouldn't do it, you're not allowed to do it. One of the reasons, again, because that's who you think you are. I am the murderer who murdered somebody earlier. I am the adulterer. I am the divorcee. I am the cheat. Whatever it is, you make an identity of your past. And that's why you feel guilty. There's no reason to feel guilty at all. It is the most stupid of psychoses, guilt. Let it go. Let the whole past go. You don't have to keep bringing it up and torturing yourself. And that way, if you can let go of the guilt of the past, you've all done bad things. I've done many bad things in my life. And I've told you many of the bad things which I've done in my life. Especially recently when my mother died. I remembered all the bad things I did. When I was about 7 or 8 years of age, could have been 9. In London there was a food craze, which was pie, eels and mash, potatoes. And eels were very popular. It was an East London dish, but it sort of went all over London. And you had these shops opening up, just selling eels, boiled eels, maybe a meat pie and mashed potatoes. That's all they sold. And so it was my mother's birthday. So I went to the eel shop, a pie and eel shop, and I bought a live eel. And I put it in a nice box with... with beautiful wrapping paper. And just an 8 or 9 year old kid with a nice sort of ribbon on it, I presented to my mother. Happy birthday, Mummy. And I did that. I was such a naughty kid. And I even then I had a lot of restraint. I actually kept a straight face. I was, you know, you're itching to laugh, you're just bursting to laugh, but if you laugh you give it away. And there's my mother, the son you love very much, giving it a present all by himself. He's made a present and he wrapped it for me. Isn't that sweet? And so she opened and this eel reared up. And she screamed. Half of London could hear her scream. I just laughed my head off. So that's what a compassionate son I was to my poor mother. There's many bad things you did like that. You let them all go, you laugh at them. So you don't punish yourself for your stupidity. That's how you let go of your bad karma. Let it go, for instance. Don't sort of keep punishing yourself for it. Ajahn, I disapproved of your answers. I disapproved one of your answers in the Q&A session. It got me upset. And I had trouble to stop thinking about it and just let you and me have different opinions. The same thing happens, for example, when my wife or mother doesn't share my opinion in some things, which is important to me, i.e. persons that mean a lot to me. How do I handle a situation like these without upsetting the mind? Well, it's persons that don't mean a lot to me. The donkey struggling the dirt in the grave works fine. But someone who means a lot to you, and I disagreed with you, or you disagreed with me. So what happens when there's disagreements? What you do is you write that disagreement on a piece of paper. And how much you hate me or your wife or husband or whatever it is. And you know the type of paper to write it on. Yeah, do it again. Take it to the toilet and flush it down. It's shitty stuff, isn't it? It's not the sort of stuff you should keep. All the negative stuff you don't keep. You let it go, and that's how you let it go. So that's what I would do. I'd just get a big store of toilet paper and a couple of pens. And when someone disagrees with you and you're really upset about it, then you actually put it on toilet paper and throw it down the toilet. There! Actually, I was just recreating this with Ajahn Bamaya. We often disagree with each other. We have good fun doing that. Sometimes I disagree with him on purpose. just to have fun. Well, why not have a bit of fun? But I told him, I said, it's just like that story of the two monks having a disagreement. Did the Buddha teach reincarnation? Is it essential to Buddhism? Or is reincarnation not really necessary to believe in? And one of them said, look, it's all about the present moment. The past is uncertain. Any previous life or future life, that's in the past or in the future. Haven't I told you to let go of the past or the future? So what's the point of reincarnation in the present moment? You know, and even the past, are you sure that you remember correctly? And the future is just, who knows what the future's going to be? So drop any sort of discussion on reincarnation. It's not important. And the other monk said, no, it is important. The Buddha taught reincarnation. He told about his own previous lives. And the purpose of reincarnation is that gives you the big picture of how much suffering there is in life. I just told you, if you realize your kids came from a previous life, they had a mother other than you in previous life, and many fathers, it's not yours to keep, it's just you're just one in a series of parents they've had in their many lives. It means it's much easier to let go. So reincarnation is really important. So I had this argument. And so they couldn't settle it between themselves. So one of them went to see the great master and said, look, you know, reincarnation is not important, it's all about the present moment. You know, just the same argument. And the master listened to him and said, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I agree with that. And so he went to his mate and said, look, the master agreed with me. He can't agree with you. So the second monk went to see him. And he said, look, it's without known past lives, how can you understand the real amount of suffering and where we came from? It's really important. The Buddha taught that. Even dependent origination, that great teaching is all about how reincarnation happens. And the master said, yeah, actually, you're right. So he went and said, no, the master agreed with me. No, he agreed with me first of all. So they both went to see him together. And they said, you know, first of all you agree with me, then you agree with the other monk. You can't do that. And the monk said, yeah, that's right. And I played that trick on Ajahn Bamaya yesterday, I think. Because he knew where it came from. So having differences, that's right. I agree with that. It's okay to have differences. Do you agree? If you don't, I agree with that. It totally undermines all arguments. Anyway, next one. what Ajahn Chah used to say when there was an argument. He'd say, say the two people, say you and you. He'd say, you are right, but not correct. Yeah. You're correct, but not right. That's really beautiful. Ajahn, why is fear always comes up when we are in unfamiliar situations? It is because we feel threatened. In unfamiliar situations, they are not safe. And so we are afraid for our safety, physical safety, first of all. So the first night that people come to this place, they usually don't sleep that well. Unfamiliar, you don't feel that secure, you don't know who's going to be creeping through your window. So the first night is always a bit scary, but after a while, that's your room, you get used to it, and you can go to sleep. It's about being at home after a while. So that's my problem, because you know my lifestyle, going into Indonesia was 12 cities in 13 days, or no, 11 cities in 13 days. So every night, for about a fortnight, I was waking up in a different bed. And that's really disconcerting. And it does happen to me. And I'm sure it's happened to you. You get up in the morning, you wake up, where the hell am I? You know, what country am I in? And it takes a couple of minutes before you look inside and, oh yeah, I'm in Indonesia. I'm in sort of the Buddhist fellowship or wherever it is. And that's a really weird lifestyle. I really enjoy it because I get used to that now. It's like fun. You wake up, where am I today? It's like interesting. Because life can be very boring as a monk. So that's very interesting. So I don't really get into fear that way. But it's just interesting. So that's physical. You have fear when you wake up in an unfamiliar surroundings. Imagine what that's like mentally when you get into unfamiliar realms of the mind. Places in meditation never been before. That's scary. And many of you in your interviews have told me scary experiences. Your body's disappeared, you've got into, you know, waiting rooms, you know, in your mind, you've got into sort of into space, wherever, and sometimes you feel that's very scary. Look, it's great fun. You've got nothing to be afraid of. I haven't had any casualties yet. Everybody actually gets much better when they experience these states. So don't be afraid. Take it from me. This is wonderful. This is good. This is what's supposed to happen. Enjoy it. Use faith and confidence in your teacher. You all know me. I'm a sort of a reliable monk. So if I say it's okay, then go for it. Enjoy it. In the unfamiliar places in your mind, which you will meet on this retreat. Get in there and have fun. You'll have the time of your life. So that's what happens, why fear comes up. It's one of the biggest of the hindrances. Ajahn, we're meditating. It is always more beneficial to remain in the passive witnessing state. When should one practice a more active state? For example, visualizations, loving kindness, affirmations to soothe the mind, access the creative principle of the mind in a positive way. If you're starting a meditation, just do the passive, be as passive as you possibly can. When you've got into jhana, when you come out, then you can start being more active and asking what's going on. So has any of you got into jhana yet? If you can, then you can be active. Otherwise, shut up and be passive. Look, you already know how to be active. You're very skilled at being active in your work, in the kitchen, and all these other things you do. So how about learning how to be totally passive and do nothing? Refine that skill, first of all, on this retreat. Because you spend the rest of your life doing things. Now, be still. Dear Ajahn, when the breath becomes very refined and subtle, it is sometimes difficult to stay mindful enough, such that subtle distractions don't creep in. Could you suggest what one could do to stay with such a refined object? Good question. Develop happiness. When the breath is very refined, sometimes we don't even notice that it's joyful. And that's one of the big hindrances in people. Joy is there, so look for it. And the very fact that I've said, look for the happiness, will solve the problem. Because I've said it, that lodges in your mind. And when you get to those peaceful states, you'll find automatically now you start looking for that happiness. And you find it, and then because it's so joyful being peaceful, then you're having too good a time, that these distractions will not affect you. Just like the story of the Malaysian couple who live in Perth. I'm sure that some of you know them. They're strong members of our Buddhist society. They were sitting watching a movie one evening. And once the movie was finished, they got up to have a cup of tea. Another went to go to the toilet. And as they got up from the sofa, then and only then, they realized many things were missing from the shelf behind the sofa. Many valuable things. And not just in that room, in other rooms as well. A burglar had been into their house while they were watching the movie and had stolen things from right behind them. And did that noise disturb them? No. They were watching the movie. And a burglar was literally maybe a foot or 2 foot behind them. Now, if you could only meditate like that. So you're watching the breath, having a wonderful time. People get up next to you, they cough, they move, they bang their cushions or whatever it is, and you don't hear them at all. You can do that when you're watching a movie. Why can't you do that when you're watching the breath? Because the breath isn't interesting. Movie is fun. So if you can start adding that joy to the breath, or whatever other object, so you're watching the breath and it's just so delightful, oh, this is so good, then all those other sounds and distractions, they can't get in. You're just having too much of a good time. So add the joy. And the other skillful means for adding the joy, if you're getting peaceful, it's very subtle, but you can't find any joy, move your attention away from your meditation object. Again, remember, to the mouth, smile. Just a tiny smile is all you need sometimes. Because then the mind is just looking for happiness and joy. It's like turning its attention in that direction. And then when you go back to meditation object, the mind sees the happiness and joy. Once it starts, it builds up, and then you're away, having a wonderful meditation. Develop the joy. That's the answer. Why do we make such a big deal about rebirth? After all, we will not remember our past lives anyway. Some people do remember their past lives. Surely Buddhism is more than just avoiding being reborn. It's part of Buddhism to avoid being reborn. Otherwise, do you want to be reborn again, as I said? Who knows where you'll be reborn next time? Maybe because you ask these silly questions. You'll be... reborn in a troop of monkeys. Is that a good idea? I don't know. But anyway, yeah, rebirth is part of Buddhism. So it's not the most important, but it's part of it, so why not talk about it? And also, it's good fun sometimes to finding out where you came from and why you are who you are. Why you came here from the other part of the world and now you're in Australia. Why? Why have you come to this Buddhist meditation retreat center? You want to know the reason why? Find out your last life and everything will be revealed. What is the story behind the little shrine? What are the other buildings and farm things from? A little shrine. Which little shrine? There's lots of little shrines in this place. But the best little shrine is in your heart. And that's where the buildings are which you've created in the past. And farm things from. I don't know, what's farm things? There's no farm things here. You stump me, I can't answer that question. You are the best question of the week because I don't know the answer to that one. Is it recommended to set a specific time frame when meditating? Or shall one do as much as they feel at the time? Is there an ideal amount of time to meditate? Yes. 1 moment is all you meditate. No longer. Present moment awareness, just now. Don't even think minutes, don't even think hours. Just 1 moment, that's the whole length of your meditation. That's the whole length of your life. You just meditate for 1 moment. If you can do that, you understand how to meditate for hours. Ajahn Brahm, during meditation, can we switch focus from the present moment to mantra chanting or any other teaching technique? Thank you. Yeah, of course you can. Do whatever you like. It's free. As long as it works. So as long as it makes you peaceful, experiment. You mentioned a lot about not having goals or aspiration because it takes you away from the present moment. On the other hand, if we do not have goals, we do not progress. Exactly. No progress, ingress. Progress is going on to the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. It has no end to it, progress. Ingress. You go in, and in, and in. You know that has an end. The center, that's where it ends. You go in to the whole in the middle of things, the emptiness. That's what the holy life means. Into the whole, empty, nothing there. Holy. Get it? You mentioned now goals are aspirations because it takes you away from the present moment. On the other hand, if we do not have goals, we do not progress. Exactly. These days, there's also a lot of talk on the law of attraction, where you think about what you want and imagine you have it. And can you talk a little about this? Is it good or is it bad? It does not work. The law of attraction. I want to have no disciples. I keep thinking, I'll have no disciples. Everybody will leave me alone. They will not ask questions. I visualized that last night. No questions in the basket. No questions in the basket. No questions. It didn't work. So that law of attraction is a myth. This is amazing how people can get conned and believe in that sort of rubbish. And it made that guy very wealthy. Why did that guy get wealthy? Because there's so many stupid people in the world that believe that rubbish. It does not work. Maybe the moment has passed, as this relates to a question about thinking at last night's Q&A session. When you were looking for the relevant sutta, maybe the sutta is, that's right, Majjhima Nikaya 19, the two kinds of thought. That's right, exactly. I keep having leaking bucket problem. The body disappears and the breath calmed down. After a while, pain in the leg starts. I can't shift it because I can't move. I'm frozen. Very good. So if you're frozen, just go back up to the mind. The leaky bucket is you're getting very peaceful, you're nice and having a wonderful, happy time, and you've still got some awareness of the body. So all that energy, it should be staying in the mind, having a beautiful time, but you've got a little bit of connection to the body, so you can't fully enjoy the beautiful mind. So remember, let go of the body as soon as possible. It doesn't belong to you. And it does much better when you let it go. It's more comfortable. This is weird, but the first time it happened, I couldn't believe that. And I'm getting old. Meditate for 50 minutes, and now I start to ache and get pains here. But you meditate for 3 or 4 hours or 5 hours, there's no pain at all. It's weird. It doesn't make sense. The longer I sit, the worse it should hurt. Well, you get into samadhi, you get into stillness, you leave the body and go into the realm of the mind. And you come out afterwards and your body is so relaxed. There's not an ache or a pain in it. You feel like you can run a marathon. That's what happens when you let the body go. When you disappear, at last, she's out of the way. He's gone. Thank God for that. And then the body looks after itself and does a much better job when you're away than when you're there. So, if you can let go of the body, it's the best possible thing for your body. As I interpret Christianity, the symbol of letting go is the crucifixion. We follow Jesus by taking up our own cross, dukkha, dying on it, letting go, in order to be resurrected into eternal life, the deathless. But the transformation is literal, excruciating from the cross, yeah. So is the moment of letting go painful or blissful, or one followed by the other? Much is made of meditation's blissful aspects. It is also painful to sit and face dukkha on the cushion. Right effort can be hard work. Talking about the crucifixion, I think some of you may have passed the office this morning because one of my friends in England sent me a Easter gift. And he says an appropriate thing for... He's actually sent it on Good Friday. And it was the last 3 minutes of the life of Brian, where all these people are being crucified on the cross. And one of them starts singing, "Look on the bright side of life." But it's so funny. And on that they have this wonderful line, which was a great one. You know, it's all about the first noble truth of suffering. Life is shit when you look at it. That was one of the lines in this very famous movie. So it was very funny, but also very profound. Even in being crucified on the cross, you can still look on the bright side. So, you're sitting down there and your legs ache and you're in pain. What should you do? Look on the bright side. This is crazy, but it's really good. So that's the Christianity which I like, as taught by Brian, in the life of Brian. There's much more wisdom in that than I've ever seen in the Bible. One of those, it's true. I put my hand up and I agree to that, because there's not much wise teachings in the Bible, but in the life of Brian they have this wonderful scene where they have this group, this rebel group trying to overthrow the Roman occupation of Israel. And they're saying, what have the Romans ever done for us? What have the Romans ever done for us? And so it's actually that they give aqueducts. We've got running water now in Jerusalem. We never had that before the Romans came. Oh, yeah, yeah. But what have the Romans done for us other than aqueducts? We've got actually paved roads. There's always mud and all over the place. And it's terrible sort of getting your horse down those roads, all sorts of potholes. We've got paved roads now. Yeah, but what have they done for us other than aqueducts and paved roads? You know, law and order. You know, you couldn't go down the streets at night, you know, before they came in. There's all these robbers and stuff. You've got laws. Yeah, yeah, okay, fair enough. What have they done for us except aqueducts, law and order, roads, you know, education? Nothing. They've done nothing. Out with the Romans. There's a great satire. I just, what has my wife ever done for me? Nothing, nothing. Out with the wife. Get divorced. It's just the negativity which we have. It's just two bad bricks simile, but done to a sort of in a nice play and very, very funny. So, you know, why is it we just always look at the faults? Because we want to get rid of the Romans. So we see all the things they haven't done. All the things the Romans have done. All the gratitude. Oh, no, that we don't count for that. Out with the government. What they've ever done for us. A lot of things. We don't look at what they've done for us. We look at what they haven't done. Out with the Labour government. Out with the Liberal government. Out with... Now that's actually life of Brian. Very, very powerful. Comedy is a great way of teaching. As you know, I employ that a lot. It's making satire. It's laughing at people. So that's with the moment of letting go, painful or blissful. It's always blissful letting go. So it is not excruciating meditation. The two types of meditation, remember I said at the beginning of this retreat, second noble truth meditation is not meditation at all. Wanting leads to suffering. That's where you get crucified. The other way, third noble truth meditation, letting go of wanting, just making peace, being kind, being gentle. It's not crucifixion at all. It's perfect peace. That's why the image of Buddhism is a person sitting meditation with no sign of distress, no gritting of the teeth, no being tortured, peaceful and happy. That's a symbol of Buddhism. You know the story of that boy in Singapore who could never actually do well at maths. And his teacher, or his parents, you know, so got tutors for him, special tutors, paid a lot of money for the best tutors, tried to get him to learn maths, nothing worked. They took him to a private school, still he was terrible at maths, and you've got to do maths to get on in life. So then they took him to a Christian school. Straight away he started doing well at mathematics. And the parents were so impressed. Why, going to a Christian school, did it work? All these other schools and tutors, why did that not work? And so they asked the son, you know, was it the discipline in the school? Was it the quality of the teacher? He said, no, none of that. When I first went into school, when I saw that picture of the boy nailed to the plus sign, I realised they were serious about mathematics. No, nailed to the plus sign, you know what that means. When the breath becomes very refined and subtle, it is sometimes difficult to stay mindful enough, such that subtle is, oh, keeping up, I don't know one. That's actually about sort of creating happiness. Some people kill mosquitoes or snakes with saying they are dangerous. I try to explain that they too are alive, so we must respect their lives, but they keep killing. So I try to explain that they would suffer from their karmic result. Life would be full of disease or be accident or they would die early. And then those people normally ask, how does it happen? This is based on Buddha's teachings, but they can't see the cause and effect. Karma vipaka, how should I explain when especially non-Buddhists do bad things without knowing Dhamma? Okay, you could say, well actually there's a point in there, isn't there? Mosquitoes are dangerous, the snakes are dangerous. So if they're dangerous, you should kill them. And the most dangerous people are people. So we should kill them too. By the same logic. You know, we create more suffering than, you know, more pain and more destruction than anybody else. So by the same logic, yeah, say, let's kill mosquitoes and snakes and let's kill you too, because you're the most dangerous. That's logical, reasonable. That's how I'd explain it. And then they go, uh-oh, I can see your point there. Because, you know, sometimes, like at the moment in Australia, you know, all these kangaroos you see, and sometimes they say there's too many kangaroos, and they just eat the crops of people, and poor farmers have a hard time finding a living. So they say that every now and again they do a cull of kangaroos. You know, they actually allow the farmers to shoot them at night, or they get in these helicopters and shoot them from the air. They kill the kangaroos because there's too many of them. Is that a good idea? And someone suggested, well actually, if that's a good idea, we should start culling human beings, because there's far too many people in Singapore. And in India, and all these other places, you know, you're from Bangladesh, there's too many people in Bangladesh, isn't there? Sometimes, when you turn the tables around, you say, you kill mosquitoes or snakes because they're dangerous, or there's too many of them. You turn it around, what about human beings? We're a species as well. We're no different than these other species, and so we should respect all species equally. So anyway, but there is karmic result of these things. What was that story? There's one very good story. These stories you collect from the newspapers. There was a fellow in the United States, he caught a mouse in his house. And once he caught the mouse in the trap, he wondered what to do with that mouse. We actually catch mice here in Buddhist mouse traps. Buddhist mouse traps don't kill them. But then what do we do with the mice? Usually in Bodhinyana Monastery, if we catch a mice, it's usually because they got into the kitchen and stolen food from the monks. We realize even for a mouse, that's bad karma, stealing from a monastery. So to teach them the result of their bad karma from stealing from a monastery, we drive them up the road to the prison farm and we release them in the prison. So they have to do their penance in the prison up the road. Let's be teaching them the law of karma. What's it? What was I thinking of? I forget what the question is. No. Anyway, what's the... I forgot. What was it? Anyway. What was the question? Anyway, I forgot it. Do you remember? I just keep thinking of the jokes and I don't think of the question. Was this the one?
The mosquito and the snake.
A mosquito and a snake, yeah. So, so there is a law of karma there, which does actually happen. So, oh, that's right. The story of the mouse was caught in the United States. And he wondered what to do with the mouse once it was caught. And so what he did, there was a bonfire, like a garden fire in the back of his house. He'd raked up some leaves and twigs and started burning it. And this cruel man threw the mouse onto the fire to burn the mouse alive. It's a good way of getting rid of the mouse. It's just a nasty thing to do. This poor little fluffy mouse, throwing it on the fire. That was bad karma. And what the mouse did, you know, it was very badly burnt, but managed to run for its life out of the bonfire into the house. Okay, if you don't want to hear the story. No, it's okay. He ran from the bonfire into the house, and his fur was alight, and he brushed past the curtains and ignited the curtains. The curtains ignited many other things, and this man's house burnt down. He lost his whole house because of the cruelty to this little mouse. He tried to burn the mouse, and the mouse ended up burning the whole house down. And that was the law of karma. Serve him right. Anyway, is craving special part of the khandhas? Since second noble truth is craving is the cause of dukkha. Why not another khandha is the cause? Because that's the main cause is craving. That is what moves you and stops you being still, wanting. It's part of doing. The reason we crave is because, you know, that's what we think we do. We're a self, and the self craves things, it wants things. And thinking that if we get what we want, then we'll be happy. So much of my life I thought, when I get what I want, then I'll be happy. And as soon as I got what I wanted, it disappointed me. It was, what is it? It was unfaithful to me. It promised me happiness, and when I got it, it wasn't good enough. I needed more. And so that's what happens in life. We always want something more. And that's called craving. And as somebody put it, and I've taken this on board, and it's one of my sayings now, if you want something more, in other words, if you have craving, if you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. That's such a profound explanation of the Four Noble Truths. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. There's no enjoyment, it's just suffering. So I don't know how far you've got in your meditation, but if you want something more, something deeper, you can't enjoy what you already are. And that's why the meditation doesn't work. You want something more, so you have no happiness, no joy with what you have. So don't want anything more. You have enough. You've arrived. You're here. Don't want, and Nibbana comes to you. You go chasing Nibbana, and it runs away from you. You sit still, and it comes to you. There used to be emus in this property before, and one of the Anagarikas once told me, you know, if you go walking after the emus will run away. They're always very scared of humans. But he sat down still, perfectly still. And of course, the emu came to him and sniffed him nose to nose. That's what happens. If you're still, things come to you. If you race after them, they always run faster and you never reach them. So if you want meditation success, if you want jhana enlightenment, stop running after it. Stay still. And it will come to you, nose to nose. Jhana. Okay, that is the last question. The question about what is the story behind the little shrine. If someone could actually explain that tomorrow, and I'll try and answer it tomorrow. But you have stumped me. So that's enough for this evening. I hope you enjoyed some profound questions, some silly questions, a couple of jokes. Is that a question? Okay. Oh, so it has. It's got a towel around it. It's brown at last. Very good. Who did that? Was that you, Santuti? Yeah, it's almost. Has anyone got a electric razor? You can try saving his little head tomorrow. Yeah?
Would that in elevation be appropriate to hug?
No. That's a... Because we're Theravada, and that's a... Is that a Mahayana bear? So you can hug those. Yeah, you can hug it. Okay. So thanks for that profound question. So, now, sadhu, sadhu.